from WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. Brooke is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. The question has raged since before the invasion of Iraq. Was the decision for war made by the White House immediately after 9/11, with the square peg of intelligence data pounded into the round hole of arguments for war, or was the administration telling the truth all along and giving peace a chance? Former White House terrorism czar Richard Clark has written that the decision was already made to force the ousting of Saddam, but until 5 weeks ago, there was little hard evidence to back up his claim. That was when a bombshell exploded in the Times of London. A story there featured a memo of the minutes of a meeting that British Prime Minister Tony Blair had with some of his top intelligence aides on July 23, 2002, at the Prime Minister's official residence, No. 10 Downing Street. The memo purportedly said that Blair was told in 2002 that the intelligence was being, quote, fixed around the Bush administration's case for war. The war began in March 2003. That story about the so-called Downing Street memo ran in Britain May 1st, 4 days before the British election. Since then, the U.S. media have largely been silent. Then, on Tuesday, at a White House press conference, Reuters reporter Steve Holland confronted the president and Prime Minister Blair.
Thank you, sir. On Iraq, the so-called Downing Street memo from July 2002 says intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of removing Saddam through military action. Mm-hmm. Is this an accurate reflection of what happened? Could both of you respond?
The following day, the Downing Street memo had a newfound urgency in major American newspapers, including USA Today. Mark Memmott wrote the USA Today story, and he joins me now. Mark, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, not only was Wednesday's story that you wrote in USA Today the first mention of the Downing Street memo in USA Today, you took pains in the story to point out that it was the first mention of the Downing Street memo. Now, that's unusual on the face of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. But, of course, the buzzword in journalism today is transparency. And if we hadn't addressed that, it would have been a pretty gaping hole in the story.
Well, let's talk about gaping holes, because the Downing Street memo came out on May 1st and has resonated loudly in the blogosphere, and certainly news organizations have been inundated in the United States by requests for more coverage of it. Yet that coverage, as you observed in your story, has been largely absent. A few mentions, nowhere on page one, and with very little follow-up.
It's ironic to some extent. I mean, last year the media was jumped on because of the Texas Air National Guard documents that CBS said it had. Bloggers were all over them about the authenticity of those. Now some in the blogosphere were all over the media for not writing about documents which almost all the media had not seen. Only the Sunday Times in London had actual copies that they said were from reliable sources. Others only had secondhand information. So that explains a lot of the reluctance, at least on the U.S. media's part, to really weigh in on this one, I think. And I know that there were attempts made to try to authenticate and obtain the information so that we could do a story. And we just never got to the point, I'm told, where we could.
It was something like 38 days from the time the memo was mentioned in the Times of London till it showed up in USA Today. Apart from the question of authenticity, any other considerations in not even mentioning the story until now?
There were several. I mean, one is we and other newspapers as well and other media had written a lot in early 2002 about how the Bush administration was beginning the drumbeat, was moving toward a decision to go to war, to take military action in Iraq. It wouldn't happen until a year later, but there were lots of stories. So I think there was some sense also among editing ranks that, well, we knew this. We knew that the Bush administration had decided well beforehand what its policy course was going to be. Yes, this is important. Yes, this is a document which seems to put it down on paper. But I think there was a sense of, well, is this old news and how important is it?
Now, there is a line in the Downing Street memo, let's say it's authentic for a moment, that the argument for war has to be fixed around intelligence gathered. And the interpretation, at least by the people who are writing to our show, is that the intelligence findings were fixed. that they were manipulated in order to bolster arguments for war. But there's some dispute about whether that's the right interpretation of those words.
Britain and the United States are separated by a common language, I think is the cliche. To someone in Britain, it's possible that that phrase, fixed around, could mean attached to or bolted on, not necessarily skewed. It's possible that that phrase, fixed around, could also mean, well, they selectively take good intelligence, and that's what they emphasize to build their case. So that's where the argument comes down to why it's so important to find out exactly what the person who wrote that meant.
So what was the event that finally gave you the confidence to go forward?
It was pretty clear that with the prime minister in town and the fact that he was going to have a joint press conference with the president, that this question was among those likely to be asked. So it was logical to get all the B matter ready about how the media had covered it, make sure I understood what our position had been along the way. And then when the question was asked, and both the president and Prime Minister Blair addressed it, the peg was clear.
Your story, there was one line that made me laugh out loud, because you mentioned someone who wrote to your paper insisting not only that you write about it, but that you give it the same incessant drumbeat coverage that you give Paris Hilton and Michael Jackson. Is that a fair comment?
I think it certainly is from the reader and especially from the advocate's point of view. Media can always be accused of going for the sensational story versus the one that has more substance. What the reader, what the advocates don't sometimes understand, of course, are the weights and the checks and balances and the decision-making process of the editors as they try to figure out how credible, how real is a story. And I think that's where the battle, if you will, was on this one.
Okay. Well, Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mark Memmott is a reporter for USA Today. If the word bubble sends a shiver down your spine, then you probably own real estate in New York or elsewhere in the Northeast Corridor, and you have read at least one of the many recent stories warning about the bubble and its looming burst. Every venerable publishing outlet in New York has weighed in. Daniel Gross wrote at least one of those stories, and he joins me now to explain Bubble Mania. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
Just for starters, what's a real estate bubble, and why are we maybe in the middle of one?
A real estate bubble is a unsustainable and seemingly inexplicable increase in the price of real estate, accompanied by the sort of speculative behavior that we saw with stocks in the 90s. In the 90s bubble, people went around and bought stocks on margin. They didn't know what they were buying. They tried to flip them. There was an assumption that things would just go up and up and up. And when the bubble burst, a lot of people got burnt. And I think in certain markets, one of them being New York, we're seeing a lot of that same type of investor-fueled behavior.
But here's the thing about bubbles. We sort of know they're eventually going to burst, but nobody can ever predict exactly when. That was absolutely the case with the dot-com bubble. It kept inflating and inflating and inflating for the longest time.
Yeah, and the difference this time around, I think, is that, you know, in the late 90s and even through 2000, the large sort of media complex collectively missed calling the bubble. If you watch CNBC or read the Wall Street Journal or Money Magazine or the personal finance magazines, there were really comparatively few serious warnings. You know, get out, the end is nigh, and we all rode over the cliff together. I think in compensation for that, you see many more people who make their living in the media as analysts, journalists, wanting to get out on the record saying, I may have missed the stock bubble, but I'm not going to miss this one. You're warned.
Now, the stories that have been just everywhere the last few weeks have been showing up in the newspapers and the magazines and the business sections, but not necessarily in the place where home buyers go when they're thinking about buying property, the real estate section. At the risk of tossing you a softball, Dan, gee, why aren't these stories on the real estate pages?
Whether it's subconscious or conscious on the part of the editors who run those sections, it doesn't behoove you to speak ill of the product that your section is there to sell. If the auto section of the New York Times were to run articles week in, week out saying driving is unsafe and it's a bad time to buy a car, it wouldn't be around for too many more months. And I think that's one of the issues that the editors of these sections are facing. They know that prices are rising. They know that elsewhere in their newspapers and in the magazine world that people are talking about a bubble. But there are all kinds of incentives, obvious and hidden, for them not to be plastering those headlines on their sections.
There's a principle in investment that it's impossible to time markets, which raises the question of this cover story line from Fortune magazine. It said, U.S. housing prices are stretching the outer limits of what's reasonable and sustainable. That story was from 2002. Now, in the June 2005 Fortune magazine, the cover story is about flipping apartments and getting rich off of it.
Time Incorporated magazines, especially with their cover stories, have a great record as kind of contraindicators. If a company makes it on to the cover of Fortune as the next great thing, like Krispy Kreme did a couple years ago, that's the time to sell the stock. And I'd point to the cover of this week's Time magazine, which is titled America's House Party. It's a long cover piece, and you can only find two paragraphs in there where they quote one economist who warns about a bubble, which to me means one thing. Look out below!
I got to go now, Dan. I have to put my house up on the market and escape with my life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daniel Gross's blog is danielgross.net. His piece, The Race to Call the Top, ran as part of New York Magazine's late May real estate coverage. Coming up, a reporter asks, whose sperm is it anyway? And OTM goes back to the science dictionary. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Journalists, or so the ideal goes, are neutral observers, disinterested chroniclers of the events of their time. Good reporters take notes without taking sides. They cover stories. They don't contrive them. In 2001, Slate magazine reporter David Plotz set out to tell the bizarre tale of a millionaire businessman turned modern eugenicist, whose idea it was to impregnate young, brilliant women with the sperm of Nobel Prize-winning men. That may sound like science fiction, but it actually happened, and Plotz himself became part of the narrative when he brought together family members and, in a very unjournalistic way, helped propel the very story he was reporting. David Plotz joins me now. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
Now, your book begins with businessman Robert Graham. Tell me about his idea, the repository for germinal choice.
Well, my book, The Genius Factory, is the story of how Robert Graham, who was a millionaire inventor of shatterproof plastic eyeglasses, decided to start a sperm bank for Nobel Prize winners in 1980. And he collected some sperm from a few Nobelists and was distributing it to women who belonged to the high IQ society Mensa, with the idea that he would breed a kind of cadre of future scientists and leaders and politicians who would reverse what he saw as the genetic degradation occurring all around him. And over 20 years, he had the sperm bank, and it fathered more than 200 children. And in 2001, I set out to try to find out what had happened to those kids.
Okay, well, that seems straightforward enough. So you just started reporting and ran a story about Graham and the children who were born from this project.
Well, I was faced with kind of an exceptional problem. Robert Graham, the founder of the bank, was dead. The records of the sperm bank were sealed. There was no way to find out who the donors had been and who the children were. So what I decided to do was to post an article on Slate.com saying, if you were involved with this bank as an employee or a donor or a child or a mother who went there, please contact me. And you can be anonymous and we'll see what we can discover of this history.
So now the dynamics of this story have changed because you are literally in the middle of it.
Exactly. Well, what happened was not at all what I expected, because I set out to do a project about genius. I set out to find out, did this experiment to breed super children work? But what happened to me was that the people who were contacting me were mothers or children or donors, not because they particularly wanted to tell their story. They were contacting me because they were searching for family members. And I had suddenly become the one person in the entire world who was in a position to connect donors to their children or children to their half-siblings. And it was a very bizarre situation for me as a journalist to find myself in.
Now, there's something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which in physics says that it's very difficult to track a subatomic particle because any means you use to track it actually changes the path of that particle. And in journalism, we call it the observer's paradox, that the very process of reporting on a story can change the outcome of that story. It would seem that you are the poster child for the observer's paradox. How did you get around that problem?
Well, we didn't get around it. You know, we were all Heisenberg all the time. The editor of Slate, Michael Kinsley, the then editor of Slate, Michael Kinsley, and his deputy, Jack Schaefer, and I talked about what we were going to do. We certainly recognized that this was a different kind of journalistic project because basically we were turning our readers into our sources in this series. And what Mike insisted on very early on was that we be totally transparent with readers about what we were doing. The problem with situations where journalists cause the story, as I certainly did cause the story, or when it's not clear to readers what's going on. And I think what we made very sure of was that readers were in a very strong position to judge how we had affected the story and whether, therefore, they should read these stories in a different way than they might read other stories.
At this stage, knowing the impact that you've had on people's lives, are you happy and satisfied that you have undertaken this project?
I'm very happy I undertook it. One point I want to make is that as I was doing this, I was behaving not really like, or not exclusively like a journalist. I was behaving like a human being. I could, you know, accept that I was creating a story and accept the emotional consequences of it. And that's what I chose to do. And I think it made it, you know, not typical journalism of the kind you find in the pages of the Washington Post every day, but it made it a strange and interesting and really kind of emotionally wrenching kind of journalism, and one that I think is much richer for it.
You've met the children who were the product of Robert Graham's, shall we say, seminal inspiration. Are these kids collectively going to save humanity?
They're not going to collectively save humanity. They are above average as a group. Some are quite extraordinary, but I don't think it is a tribute to the genius sperm that they got. I think it is largely a tribute to the kind of mothers they have. You ask yourself, what kind of mother goes to a Nobel Prize sperm bank? It's the kind of mother who is bound and determined to have an accomplished child. In most cases, they would have raised remarkable children had they gone to the Nobel Prize sperm bank or had they gone to Joe's Discount Sperm Warehouse.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Slate.com's David Plotz is author of The Genius Factory, The Curious History of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. If you were paying close attention to the previous interview, you might have noticed that I invoked the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to get at the idea that journalists, as observers, will necessarily affect the outcome of whatever it is they observe. If you weren't paying close attention, here's a reminder. Now, there's something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which in physics says that it's very difficult to track a subatomic particle because any means you use to track it actually changes
the path of that particle. And in journalism, we call it the observer's paradox, that the very process of reporting on a story can change the outcome of that story.
Okay, now the producers of this show have very quickly pointed out to me that my cultural fluency about science is, you know, a little lacking. A quick Nexus search shows that I'm not the only one in the media who would benefit from a conversation with John Rennie. Rennie is the editor-in-chief of Scientific American, and he joins me now to set me straight on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and other scientific principles. John, welcome back to OTM.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks to be here, Bob.
All right. Now, I felt pretty confident invoking Heisenberg to make that analogy, but I didn't get it quite right, did I?
Ah, well, you see, Bob, you're right. In physics, there are always concerns about how when you make an observation, you might be perturbing the system. But that's not what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle actually talks about something that's kind of more devious about the way the universe is set up. It says that certain properties of things have a kind of reciprocal relationship in such a way that the more precisely you know the value of one of these traits, the other trait becomes less precise. So, for example, the more precisely you know the position of a bullet at any one moment, the less precisely you know what its velocity is. Here's one way you could try to understand that. You can take a photograph of the bullet as it whizzes by, and you look at the picture, and you get a little bit of blurring in that picture of the image. From that blurring, you can calculate, maybe with a great deal of certainty, exactly what the velocity of the bullet is. But unfortunately, because of that blurring, you now don't know what the exact position of that bullet was. If you use a shorter shutter speed, you can get to the point where you know the precise position of the bullet, but now the bullet looks completely motionless in your picture, and you have no idea of what its velocity was anymore.
Okay, mea culpa. What analogy might I have used from science to communicate the idea of this observer's paradox?
Well, the observer's paradox is a little bit closer to something called Schrödinger's cat. This comes from a kind of whimsical thought problem that was proposed a long time ago in which suppose that you had a mechanism set up that will release a small amount of poison gas and that is controlled by some kind of radioactive device. You know over a certain amount of time that it will definitely decay and will set off the poison gas, but you don't know exactly when that will happen. Now, you put this in a box with a cat, and you can't look inside the box. And the question is, at any given moment, is the cat alive or is it dead? Our usual intuition of these things says the cat must surely be either alive or dead at any one time, but that's not necessarily what physics says is happening. According to physics, when you open that box and look at it, you're collapsing the possibilities, and that's the moment the cat becomes truly either alive or dead. That's more like the observer's paradox you were talking about.
John, I'm just wondering, you know, February, pronounced without the first R, has been mispronounced so often that it's now in the dictionary under the incorrect pronunciation, as are a number of other words. Is it possible that people like me have been so abusing the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that it has somehow evolved into a useful term anyway, because when we use it, people fully understand the point we're trying to make?
And I suppose we could fill a whole library with ideas and words that people are misusing. But I think still it's worthwhile for people like me to come out here and try to at least set people straight on what some of these scientific ideas mean, partly because it helps people understand the science that much better, but also because sometimes people are missing the opportunity for some other perfectly good metaphor. Why misuse one when maybe there's some other circumstance out there that's just begging to have the Heisenberg uncertainty principle used right?
Well, John, as always, thanks very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
John Rennie is editor-in-chief of Scientific American. The fight against the epidemic of HIV/AIDS in Africa is fraught with obstacles, among them poverty, poor education, superstition, and sometimes erratic, even counterproductive, government measures. In such an environment, the role of media becomes especially critical. But for 20 years, that role has often been confined to the bloodless recitation of government statistics, reporting that did little to increase the awareness of the life and death stakes on the ground. That's where the organization InterNews and its Local Voices project comes in. The U.S. Agency for International Development funded program trains journalists to understand the underlying science of the epidemic and to report on it from a more human perspective. Cece Fadope is the resident advisor in Nigeria. Mia Milan holds the same post in Kenya. And she says,
one of the challenges 2 years ago when I went to Kenya was the fact that journalists always only had stories that would state statistics or that would state the opening of a project or a new office of a specific project. And what we have been trying to change over the past 2 years is to give AIDS a human face. In other words, teach them to have a case study and a story and to make the story accessible to the average person on the street. And we've also been trying to get them access to accurate statistics, access to CDC figures, that sort of thing, and also to get them to do follow-up stories on a specific issue. And as a result of that, we have managed to, on the two main, the biggest radio stations in Kenya, the state broadcaster, the KBC, and Radio Citizen, to establish two unsponsored HIV-AIDS slots that now, on a weekly basis, covers HIV-AIDS stories of a quality standard. There will always be a case study in, there will always be opportunities for people to call in, and there will always be credible experts in the studio.
Mia, as long as we're talking about KBC, it has a weekly show called A Stitch in Time that takes a very unusual approach. Can you describe it?
It is an hour-long show that's broadcast on Thursday mornings. It will always start with a pre-recorded package that has a case study and that would explain a problem. And then it would be followed by live experts in the studio where people could call in or send cell phone text messages to ask questions. Since the program started, it's become so popular that on average they have 20 text messages, too many to be able to read on air. And there's been tangible results as a result of this program. One example is a journalist did a story on matatus in Kenya. Matatus are public minibus taxis.
Now, these drivers of minibuses were actually having sex with their passengers in exchange for free rides, correct?
Yeah, actually not just passengers, but very specific passengers, schoolgirls. That program was broadcast about a year ago. A year later, the government has announced a fully-fledged program for matatu drivers and has publicly acknowledged that this program played a big role in it.
Cece, tell me what's happening in Nigeria.
Before InterNews came on the scene, we'd hear a lot of reports in Nigeria about South Africa, about Uganda, but there was local denial of the spread of HIV in country. So now we're reporting information about communities in Nigeria, and people are seeing firsthand other people who are living positively with HIV so that they can begin to address their issue. You have to understand, Bob, Nigeria has been under military rule for a long time, and it's through democracy that now information is also being democratized.
Is there any evidence that Local Voices, your programming through InterNews, is actually having an effect cutting through forces that militate against awareness?
One of the ways that InterNews has been working with journalists in Nigeria is to look at the language of reporting about HIV and AIDS. For example, in the northern part of Nigeria, state of Kano, the house award for HIV and AIDS is literally the disease that shrinks people to death. And so a lot of people were afraid when they became infected to come out, to say that they were infected and get the care and treatment that they need. After we worked with some of the Radio Kano journalists, they started a dialogue within their news organization about how they should continue to use that word to report about HIV. Over the last 3 months, they've been having that debate and that dialogue and talking with imams, actually. And so they've come up with a new phrase to describe HIV that is no longer the disease that shrinks people to death, but the disease that weakens the human body. And it's a little more accurate because people are living with HIV. They might be a little weaker, but people are living comfortably with HIV. So we found that to be one of the differences that the Local Voices Project is making.
And in Kenya, Mia?
One thing that I thought would be nice to say in particularly Kenya is because ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, are becoming so rapidly available, journalists all of a sudden have to report on scientific issues that they have no
exactly.
knowledge of. And it's a great challenge to, all of a sudden, they need to know why can ARVs cause resistance? And how do funding principles work? You know, how do you access which program? And what drug combination you can take with others? And they need to report this. Generally, they have absolutely no science background. And you can comfortably report on HIV when it comes to stigma and discrimination and not know about its science. But when it comes to ARVs, and it's all over Africa now, there's going to have to be a drastic increase on the scientific knowledge of journalists.
Is Internews doing anything to give the reporters the basic science background that they need to sufficiently cover this story?
Absolutely. Our workshops will normally be around a theme. So say if it's, for instance, an ARV workshop, we will make sure that this journalist understands the basic science of ARVs. It will be an expert that comes in and explains it. We will make sure that they meet a person who's using ARVs and they understand the social principles of it, of how do you, if you have to hide it at home, or how other people respond to you if you take it. And then we will actually take them to a site visit where ARVs are being handed out, and they will actually see how that process works, and we will assist them to compiling a story and actually be there every step along the way when they do that.
And we also help them analyze and interpret data so that when they're reporting about numbers, about procurement of ARVs, all of that makes sense in a way that people can understand it.
Mia, Cece, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Mia Milan and Cece Fadope work for the Internews program Local Voices, which aims to improve media coverage of HIV/AIDS in Africa and Asia. Coming up, dangerous books, a whole mess of studies, and the TV series that had an answer for everything. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Here's one for you. What does the Communist Manifesto have in common with the feminine mystique? Both appear on a top 10 list of the most harmful books of the 19th and 20th centuries, published last week by Human Events magazine. The venerable Conservative Weekly asked a panel of prominent conservatives to nominate books and then vote on them. One of the judges was Herb London, president of the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He joins me now to parse the results. Herb, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
So, the top three most harmful books were determined to be, in this order, The Communist Manifesto, Mein Kampf, and quotations from Chairman Mao. First of all, were those pretty much consensus picks?
Well, I can't answer that question. I can only tell you that they were three of my picks. Now, you've mentioned others as well, but they were not necessarily my picks. The Feminist Mystique, well, I think may have undermined the relationship between men and women in some way, was not a book that I described as among the most damaging to civilization.
And that was the criterion, damaging to civilization.
Well, in a sense, yes, books that had a kind of pernicious effect on society.
Isn't it true, though, that books don't hurt people, that people hurt people?
Oh, I don't believe that for a minute. Books can sometimes be very, very dangerous. And that's not to say that I believe in censorship at all. In fact, I assign books of precisely this variety to my students. But it's important for them to understand why there is very often a mass psychosis in society and how books play a role in making that happen. Keep in mind that it was not merely the events at Versailles that led to the rise of Nazism. It was also books like Mein Kampf.
I want to go down to number four on the list. That's Alfred Kinsey's Sexual Behavior in the Human Male.
I didn't select that one either. So, I mean, part of the difficulty that I have here is that you're asking me to comment about books that I did not select. But it's okay. If I'll be happy to talk about that if you like.
Well, apparently there was some sort of consensus in the jury. Do you know why it was deemed to be so harmful?
Well, probably because conventional notions of sexuality were changed and the relationship between men and women changed in the process. Normative behavior became very different as a result of the Kinsey Report and what was alleged to be the great changes that were occurring in American sexuality.
And next thing you know, you got like Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is talking about, you got man-on-dog sex.
Well, I won't even comment on that. I'm not going to dignify that comment. But all I'm saying to you is that if you're looking at normative behavior, clearly changed as a result of the Kinsey Report.
There were the top 10, or the bottom 10. I don't know how you would measure this. But there was also a sort of dishonorable mention list. And I want to go to that for a moment. On the second tier were Ralph Nader's famous book, Unsafe at Any Speed, and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Now, those books were widely credited with opening the world's eyes to corporate mischief. What part of those books harmed society?
Well, I'll tell you, because there, I think there is an excellent case to be made against Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson's book led to the net result that DDT could not be employed. There is very little evidence that DDT is harmful. In fact, it could be swallowed without having an adverse effect. And if you want to look at the rise of malaria in Africa and the millions of young children that die each year because of mosquito bites, from a humanitarian standpoint, it seems to me that one of the things you would want to do is introduce DDT into that continent. Now, I don't understand why people, including many people in this country, believe that DDT should be banned, largely based on the mystical science, and I say mystical and I underscore that word, science of Rachel Carson.
What would Human Events Magazine and the jury that you were impaneled with do with these books? Would it suppress them now? Would it have suppressed them at the time?
Well, it may very well be that when you consider in retrospect the damage that some of these books have caused in civilization and the millions of lives that were lost in the process, maybe that would have been an appropriate trade-off. Now, I think they are very appropriate historical documents to tell you something about the given view of a people during a certain period.
Why did you get involved in this?
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, I often think about books that may have had a pernicious effect on civilization, books that led to massive slaughter. I thought of it as an academic exercise. I can't speak for the other judges. In fact, I don't even know who some of these judges are. So I have no idea whether this was a matter taken seriously, whether these were people who could be regarded as serious people. I mean, if you're trying to say, in effect, that this was a silly exercise, well, of course, you're entitled to do that. But I can't be in the position of doing that because I was not entirely responsible for the entire exercise. All I could take responsibility for were the 10 books I selected.
Okay. Well, Herb, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Herb London is president of the Hudson Institute and one of the jurors in Human Events Magazine's list of the most harmful books of the last two centuries. As we've seen, harmful or healthy is a question not likely to yield unanimous answers, whether about DDT, literature, or, as it turns out, media. Scientists worldwide are hard at work determining the effects of mass media on the human subject. Many humans, unfortunately, are too busy being affected, either positively or negatively, to keep track of the science. So, in the interest of keeping listeners up to date with the latest research on the media, we bring you the highlights of a year's worth of media studies. We start with a study released last summer by researchers at the University of Washington. They found that for every hour of TV added to the average TV diet of toddlers, the likelihood that they would suffer attention problems by age 7 went up 10%. Also last summer, researchers in New Zealand determined that watching more than 2 hours of TV a day as a child makes it more likely that you'll grow up to be a smoker, overweight, out of shape, and with high cholesterol. In September, the RAND Corporation announced that teenagers who watched programming with sexual content, which, incidentally, was determined to be most of it, were more likely to initiate sexual intercourse. Monkey see, monkey do seemed to be the conclusion in that study, at least where sex was concerned. But could the explanation lie elsewhere? Scientists at the University of Florence in Italy last year announced that watching television may actually hasten puberty. Kids who were exposed to more TV than they were accustomed to started producing less melatonin, a hormone whose levels drop at the onset of puberty. When they were deprived of TV, their melatonin levels spiked. But lest you think all the research is being conducted by out-of-touch academics, we direct you to another story from last fall, this one from Nick at Night and TV Land. It found that families who dine together are more likely to describe themselves as very satisfied with the closeness of their families, and to make other types of family activity a priority. High on that list of activities, watching TV together. Which can have its own benefits, especially if you happen to be a homophobic family. A study released in April from the University of Minnesota found that exposure to positive portrayals of gay characters on TV shows like 6 Feet Under and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy can reduce prejudice among viewers. So TV can make us more sensitive, except when it doesn't. Also in April, researchers at the University of Washington reported that the more television four-year-olds watch, the more likely they are to become bullies later on at school. To review, TV leads to bullying, obesity, puberty, attention problems, and sexual promiscuity, unless viewed with the rest of the family, in which case you are guaranteed happiness. Or not.
Science!
For the children of the 70s and 80s, the Tube offered at least one program that tried to counteract the more negative effects of TV watching. Between 1972 and 1988, ABC's after-school specials aired in the after-school hours, and now you can relive the whole experience on DVD. In case you aren't of the Christy McNichol generation, the series covered real teen issues like bullying, drinking, and sex. They were melodramatic, hysterical, and hokey, but for all that, they ran for nearly 20 years, won Emmys, film festivals, and even a Peabody Award. Earlier this year, we sent Sarah Lemanchek to see how the after-school specials play in 2005.
Everybody who grew up in the 70s and 80s remembers them, or at least remembers that electric mix of young stars, campy tragedy, and good, solid moral lessons.
There was one I remember that I think it was about a basketball player. He was in high school.
I remember we were forced to watch him in health class, and I remember Scott Baio freaking out on drugs and getting hit over the head in the water.
There's a good one about gonorrhea, I remember.
And somehow, I think it was his little brother burnt his eyes with some bleach, and this basketball player couldn't read the back of the bottle to get him some help to flush his eyes with water. And I think Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was somehow a guest star on it.
But aside from titillating details about sex or illuminating the inevitable tragedy of mixing illiteracy with bleach, there was a real effort behind these stories to look into the lives of teenagers and to address them, not as children or adults, but as something in between, which was pretty startling. Media writer for the Chicago Tribune, Maureen Ryan.
Well, I think it was something in the culture. I just remember in the 70s we had the book Free to Be You and Me. We had books like, Our Bodies, Ourselves, I remember, you know, looking around my friends' houses for The Joy of Sex and finding it in, you know, some secret drawer. It just seemed like there was much more of an air of exploration in terms of topics that might now today be considered inappropriate for kids or young adults.
If adults could have dirty, messy lives, then suddenly it seemed that perhaps teenagers did too, at least the teens on the ABC after-school specials, like Christy McNichol as a foster kid obsessed with her own isolation.
Listen, Carly.
No, you listen. Me and Harvey and Thomas J. were like pinballs. Somebody came along with a dime, put it in, pushed a button, and out we came, ready or not. You don't see pinballs helping each other now, do you? Because they can't. They're just things.
I think really what made them so compelling was that, you know, if you think about probably the most popular series starring, you know, teenagers or alleged teenagers in the 70s was Happy Days. And, you know, while series like Maude and All in the Family were exploring social issues in a really compelling way, I don't think there was as much that was aimed at or dealt with young people on primetime television. It was just like, oh, my gosh, they're really talking about this on TV. And, you know, it's for young people. It just seemed out of step almost with what was happening in primetime as far as younger people were concerned.
Happy Days premiered in 1974, around the same time the ABC after-school specials were picking up momentum. So if you were 12, you had two models of real life on TV, one where the central plot was who will take Joni to the fall social, and in a pinch you knew it'd be Fonzie, or a high school girl staging a fire drill by climbing out her bedroom window in case her alcoholic mother burnt the house down.
Francesca, how could you? What are you trying to do?
We're having a fire drill.
A what?
A fire drill. You start drinking and then smoke in bed. So what else could we do? We have to protect ourselves.
Alateen-inspired fire drills might not be typical. In fact, a hallmark of the ABC after-school special became the extreme nature of the lives portrayed on the screen. But they did acknowledge that there was more to adolescence than sock hops.
The after-school special just depicted more or less average kids doing average things and having average or above average or maybe a little bit slightly unrealistic problems. But there was a completely wonderful earnestness about them. They just took these young adult novels that are still well-respected and turned them into these little tales that kids could kind of identify with and relate to.
Fast forward a few years. The ABC specials ended in 1988. 2 years later, the Fox network came out with Beverly Hills 90210, a serial drama revolving around a group of teenagers, fashion, and money. Through this gaggle of rich, overprivileged kids, Fox explored teen complexities like alcoholism, divorce, drug use, sex, rape, eating disorders, and what it's like to get a Porsche for your 16th birthday. And a new trope was formed.
Yeah, I think the legacy for us was the second generation one. I mean, you know, it went after school special to 90210, and I suppose we're picking up the baton from 90210.
Josh Schwartz is the 28-year-old executive producer for The OC, the latest and hottest incarnation of teen TV, which somehow doesn't feel that different from pinballs. Sure, you'd have to make some sort of PS2 reference, and everyone would look a lot flashier than Christy McNichol ever did. But despite that, Josh at least seems earnest in his desire to help.
We take it very seriously that we have younger viewers, and we believe the best way to reach that audience is to create an honest conversation with them in which you're just showing behavior, but not necessarily glamorizing it. And when the consequences are shown for that behavior, it has a lot more of an impact. So we don't necessarily say Marissa drinking is a bad thing. However, her life and the consequences of her drinking certainly won't inspire anyone to go pick up the bottle.
You could almost see the ABC After School special peeking out behind all those Prada bags. Melodrama, extreme situations, and yes, morality. Like when the character Ryan finds out his girlfriend is pregnant.
She got pregnant, and he did the right thing, and as far as he knew, went to stand by her and help her through that and be a supportive and loving, you know, father, even if it wasn't his child. No one took a position with Ryan and sort of reprimanded him, but he definitely had to endure the consequences of his actions.
And we learned all about those consequences in the 1980 Schoolboy Father with Rob Lowe and Dana Plato. Only Rob Lowe's consequences lasted for about an hour, whereas in The OC, a teen pregnancy can hang out in the subplot for an entire season, lurking behind countless party scenes, fast cars, and endless days of teen ennui. But whether it's an hour or a season, kids still identify with a floundering teen or 25-year-old adult, even if they're driving an SUV instead of their mom's station wagon.
What's amazing to me is how much they relate to the characters, because you would think that their situations are totally unrelatable, but, I mean, the show is true, is at its core about what it's like to be an outsider, and so many kids go to school every day feeling that way. But there's also elements of, you know, the music the kids listen to, the references they make, the clothes they wear. There's that connection as well. But I think the emotional lives of the characters ring true.
There's much more of an emphasis on how to make this cool, how to make it hip.
But critic Maureen Ryan is still holding a candle for the ABC After School specials.
That's what was great about these shows. They didn't really pretend that kids had all the answers or knew how to dress or knew how to act or had the right kind of friends. They sort of just assumed that kids were flailing around and didn't necessarily know what to do in their lives. And now I find that kids who are supposedly 16-year-old characters on TV have lives far more complex and sort of racy than I think my life is right now.
The lives of teens on TV were never about reality, whether it's Joni Cunningham or the OC's Marissa Cooper. And really, Helen Hunt throwing herself out the window the first time she tried Angel Dust isn't totally realistic either. But behind the morals and the hyperbolic plots, the ABC specials devoted 1 hour of programming to one kid and one problem. And then they did something revolutionary. They said it mattered. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
And by the way, Thomas J., something just occurred to me.
What's that?
We don't always have to be pinballs.
Pinballs?
Because pinballs can't help what happens to them. But you and I can, and Harvey can. Like the time I ran away. But I came back. I mean, it doesn't sound like much. But it was me deciding something about my life. So as long as we're deciding, we don't have to be pinballs.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited this week by Consensus. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. On the web at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.